Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Jennifer Ackerman. Today, I'm reading from the December edition of National Geographic Magazine. Our first article is written by Emma Lira, titled Fortress of Faith, an inside look at the fabled Alhambra, where Spain's last Muslim kingdom ruled for nearly 300 years. Jesus Bermudez has deep ties to the Alhambra. Born in the fortress, built on an opposing hill in Granada, Spain, he grew up within the palace's walls. When his father became director of the Alhambra Museum in mid-century, the family moved into a house inside the monument. It was the stage, as he calls it, on which his days played out, an upbringing that steeped him in its legends and history from an early age, and inspired an enduring devotion to it. For nearly four decades, Bermudez has been the archaeologist and conservator at the Alhambra, seen as the crowning glory of the nearly 800-year Muslim reign on the Iberian Peninsula. Though he moves through the complex with the easy familiarity of navigating one's own home, he still manages to impart a sense of wonder, as if glimpsing it for the first time. He stops often to greet student groups, guards, guides, and gardeners. He displays the same pride I imagine the sultans must have had when they showed their palace to visitors. Bermudez is the ideal guide for a behind-the-scenes tour and has also written the official guide. Starting from the Gate of Justice, the largest of the Alhambra's four entry points, we explore not only its trademark courtyards and towers, but also the recesses that few are allowed to see, places where fact intermingles with fable. As researchers continue to plumb its depths, the Alhambra remains a site for archaeology and restoration, including a rebirth of one of its most enigmatic works of art, recently completed after nearly 20 years. The Alhambra is first and foremost a Palatine city, he says. It was the seat of the head of state, with military barracks, a courtly city, and a set of palaces built over the course of 2.5 centuries. The monument grew over time from the primitive Alcazaba, or fortress, built by Muhammad I, beginning in 1238, to later palaces reflecting the Nasrid dynasty's sumptuous style. A line of sultans from the Nasser family ruled until 1492, when this last stronghold of Muslim authority on the peninsula was toppled by a newly unified Spanish monarchy after the marriage of Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon. During the 254 years the Nasrids governed the Granada Emirate, which extended far beyond the city itself, this part of today's Andalusia region was frozen in time, maintaining a feudal society secluded in an idyllic oasis, Bermudez explains. And yet the kingdom left a legacy in a monument considered the pinnacle of the beauty and architectural refinement born of Al-Andalus, as the larger Muslim-ruled region was known. History would never forget it. With Granada's fall, a succession of Catholic governors ran the fortress until the beginning of the 19th century, when it was occupied by Napoleon's troops. They decimated it on their departure. The Spanish crown eventually ceded it to the state, and it became a national monument in 1870. Today, the Palatine city is alive again, with a court of officials at its service, a bureaucracy that keeps it running, and strict entry protocols, as if we're foreign envoys bearing a message for the emir. One of the most notable envoys to Spain is the reason so many know of this corner of the world today. The writer Washington Irving was a diplomat posted at the American Embassy in Madrid when he visited Granada in 1829. That was 17 years after Napoleon's troop had decamped and what remained deteriorated from neglect. Rooms were plundered, the pools became washing areas, the courtyards were turned into corrals, and families who had nowhere else to go settled in the empty spaces. It went from being a castle of kings to a refuge for outcasts, but it was always inhabited, says Bermudez. And that's what kept it standing. The squatters of the Alhambra, Bermudez calls them. Irving gave them a more romantic name, the Children of the Alhambra. It was the vagrants, the bandits, the disinherited who, together with the ghosts of the defeated, populated his Tales of the Alhambra, unveiling the city and putting it on the tourist map. Still in every bookstore in the city and widely translated, the book perpetuated the fortress's romantic aura, reminiscent of 1001 Nights. Other notables had set foot in Granada, but none had the impact of Irving. Given the weight of his influence, his single statue, set just off the Cuesta del Gomeres, a historic path to the fortress, seems a lukewarm tribute. When Irving arrived at the Alhambra with his traveling companion, a Russian diplomat, they were appalled that visitors, even dignitaries, had left their mark and graffiti, their names and notes scrawled on its walls. The Russian provided a leather-bound guest book to discourage the practice. Thousands of signatures filled that volume for the next 43 years. It was an early glimmer of recognition of the structure's value. Though his fellow traveler soon departed, Irving would stay on for several months. Spellbound, he wrote, in this old enchanted pile. He ensconced himself in royal chambers that opened up onto picturesque Linda Jar Garden. Mateo Jimenez, a self-described son of the Alhambra, who claimed his ancestors had lived in the fortress for generations, offered himself up as a servant and guide, recounting the family lore. Places where Irving set his reflections and accounts can still be seen today, such as the reconstructed Gate of the Seven Floors. Popular legend holds that Beobdil, the last sultan, fled through that gate, imploring that it be sealed after his departure. Irving's story describes a succession of passages in which the sultan would have hidden a magnificent treasure in case he ever managed to return. Another spot, the Tower of the Princesses, later renamed after Irving's tale, was the setting for his story of three Muslim princesses who fall for Christian captives. The book made the fortress an object of desire and need to visit it, to discover it, says Bermudez. Today we know this is also part of our heritage. Preserving a universal monument, such as the Alhambra, also means preserving all the values from the past. The Alhambra has always enraptured those from the outside. In January 1492, Queen Isabella, leading a military procession, began her triumphant ascent up the Cuesta de Gomeres on horseback to the Alhambra, which translates to the red for the fortress's pink-hued stone. The reconquest, lasting more than 700 years, had rolled back Muslim territories one by one across the peninsula. A papal order authorized this final crusade, resulting in a 10-year war waged for control of the holdout Granada kingdom. When the keys to the Alhambra were finally surrendered, chroniclers noted Isabella's surprise as she took in fine details inside the bastion that had long been forbidden to her. Its intricate latticework, honeycombed vaulting, the infinite geometry of its tiles, trickling pools that mirrored the magnificent facades. The Alhambra had been an impregnable fortress for almost three centuries. One might expect a Christian queen to reduce it to ashes, erasing from its walls the inscriptions praising Allah. Instead, she ordered that it be left untouched. What's more, she determined it would be her destiny for eternity, something that the unfortunate Boabdil could not fulfill. I will and command that if I should die outside the city of Granada, my entire body be taken, as it is, without delay, to the city. When she died in 1504 at her residence in the town of Medina del Campo, her coffin was sent on a three-week journey to Granada. The Alhambra, emptied of its Nasrid court just 12 years before, would be the final resting place of the Catholic queen. initially interred in the fortress, her remains, along with those of her husband, King Ferdinand, were later transferred to the Royal Chapel of Granada. While on his honeymoon, several years later, King Charles V, Isabella's grandson, visited the city conquered by his grandparents. Grasping the symbolic value, he set out to designate his own palace in the Alhambra. Construction took more than a century, and the king never lived there, but Bermudez considers that beside the point. It superimposed a new narrative. Charles used the original architecture as a base to build anew, a metaphor for triumph, and placing himself just that little bit higher, Bermudez says. Standing adjacent to the three Nasrid palaces, the Mexar, the Comares, and the Palace of the Lions, collectively the undisputed jewel in the crown for visitors, the square, rigid structure built for the Spanish king was likened to a meteor by one architect. Inside the central colonnade of Charles's palace, Bermudez pulls out a key the size of his forearm and opens a door to a stone staircase. The Stairway of Time, the Alhambra staff calls it. We descend in semi-darkness to another gate. My eyes struggle to adjust before I'm dazzled by bright light. Bermudez wields a new key, and, as if enchanted, I'm suddenly standing in the courtyard of the Myrtles, named for the bushes that surround its rectangular pool, and the Comares Palace. Yes, a bit lower than Charles's. In a moment, we transition from Renaissance sobriety to a saturation of the senses, from the victors to the vanquished. The staircase, built in 1580, was intended to do precisely that, to unite the old royal house with a new one. Tourists view our sudden apparition as if we were ghosts from the past. With a mischievous smile, Bermudez closes the door behind us. Some 2 million people visit the Alhambra each year, but they're limited to about 20% of the site. Bermudez guides me through some of the hidden parts, namely an underground network. These are modest and functional rooms, he says, kept out of sight, as they were back then, the domain of servants and guards who kept the palace running. Some also held prisoners. We peer into one of the complex's 20 dungeons, which was discovered just over a century ago. After the fall of Granada, the queen herself rushed to free Christian prisoners, as she had done in the Muslim stronghold of Magala, where an officer from the Netherlands told her he'd been held for more than 40 years. Still in the bowels, we make our way to a large cistern, which more readily resembles a cathedral, with its barrel-vaulted naves and sheer size. The underground structures also provided a cool, stable temperature to store grain and other staples. As we descend by ladder into a cave-like silo, it strikes me as the place where the Alhambra's legendary passageways could begin. I instinctively search with my headlamp. None are here, but they do exist. One level up, members of the Royal Guard would have been posted beneath the throne room and the Camara's Tower, ready to intervene in a crisis. We walk through the tunnels, aware that tourists, marveling at the magnificence of the room, cannot imagine the infrastructure that lay beneath. Bermudez unlocks a door. A flashlight illuminates a staircase that leads deep into the earth and, after 200 steps down, to yet another door. It opens into the heart of the woods just outside the walls. We're a short distance from the Darro River. It would have been an easy and clandestine way to leave the fortress. In 1359, Muhammad V, the 8th Nasrid monarch, was ousted by a revolt that put his half-brother in his place. In the middle of the night, rebels scaled the walls and knifed the guards. Barely 20 years old, the rightful sultan escaped, some say through a passageway to the Camara's Tower. Was this the place where he would have arrived breathless and been spirited away? The coup was a game of thrones involving changing loyalties, including that of his Christian ally, Peter of Castile. After 3 years, Muhammad V returned to his throne. Without that subsequent prosperous and peaceful 30-year reign, the Alhambra, as we know it today, would not exist. Muhammad ushered in the dynasty's golden age. He built what many consider to be the most striking spot in the Alhambra, the courtyard with a central fountain ringed by a dozen lion statues, and he continued his father's tradition of embellishing palaces with another art form, Arabic inscriptions. The Alhambra is a palace of poems, an architecture of words, says José Miguel Puerta Vilches, author of Reading the Alhambra, which decodes the inscriptions on its walls. Like Bermudez, he spent his life studying this place and translating it to the world. If it lost its supports, columns, and arcades, the building would be held up by words alone, he says, referring to its ubiquitous calligraphic panels. Leaning on his knowledge, I see a different Alhambra, with a language barrier, one that remains largely inaccessible to those who inherited it. Verses run along its walls, curl in cartouches, and even meet in closets. Some are carved in plaster, others in wood, or meticulously inscribed on tiles. The omnipresent motto of the Nasrid House, "There is no conqueror but God," alternates on the walls with greetings for visitors, including blessing, perpetual health, and fortune. In reality, the Alhambra was designed to praise God and the Sultan as God's earthly representative. The ornamental script envelops visitors as if they were inside a monumental book, but the power of the written word didn't end there. The Diwan al-Insa, the Office of Correspondence and Records, was created around 1273 and run by a master of two nuanced arts, diplomacy and writing. His function was propagandistic, says Puerta Vilches. The text had to be not only correct, but beautiful, poetic, capable, and praising God, the dynasty, and the Sultan. The person with the best command of the language, the Khatib, became a double vizier, head of that office and prime minister, the most powerful man in the kingdom after the Sultan. Puerta Vilches regards the kingdom's great poets as if he had worked with them himself, composing verses or transcribing internal documents that serve as invaluable chronicles of a tempestuous era. In his view, it's the swan song of the dynasty, aware of its geographic isolation on the peninsula and the inevitability of its fall. Written mainly by three successive poets who headed the chancellery in the 14th century, the Alhambra's epigraphs represent some of the Nasrid's most dazzling contributions to Islamic art, perhaps an attempt to demonstrate a grandeur that was not going to last much longer. Of the two forms of Arabic used, the Nashki, or cursive, is easily visible, but the Kufic form may go unnoticed even by a visitor who knows the language. With a rectilinear style, it can masquerade as a geometric element, blending into the decor. In the Palace of the Lions, poet Ibn Zamarik and Muhammad might have had their boldest collaboration. Its fountain, magnificently sculpted so that the rock grain simulates the lion's muscles, contains a symbolic message. It features the word Caliph, Islam's highest leader, whose role transcends that of Sultan. The change in title imbued Muhammad, a political figure, with religious authority, an impeccable example of 14th century PR. Those were difficult times, says Puerta Vilches. The Sultan needed to legitimize his power, not to Christians, so much as to his own people. The same palace also holds a rare artwork in the Hall of the Kings, which, after a two-decade effort, has just been restored to its former glory. Three painted scenes include human figures, atypical in Islamic art. But that's not the only enigma. Presiding over the central dome, 10 men, dressed in luxurious Muslim-style garb, appear to be watching over the space. One theory maintains they're the first 10 Nasrid rulers, hence the room's name, Two other paintings depict medieval court vignettes in which Christian and Muslim knights hunt, joust, and rescue maidens. Muslims always win in these scenarios. At least two royal weddings took place in the Hall of the Kings, says Puerto Villages. These paintings extolled the splendor of the Nazarene court and were meant to be seen. The 14th century works were eventually hidden when the room was absorbed into a 16th century church. Over time, they deteriorated. The original canvases were made from horsehide, tanned with alum, and embellished with natural tempera pigments, then attached to wooden frames shaped like inverted boat hulls, and covered with tar and plaster to prevent fire or water damage. Artisans from different trades were involved, specialists in wood, painting, and leather. Together, they created a masterpiece whose execution technique is unknown in the Spanish Muslim world, says Elena Correa, who heads the Alhambra's restoration department. A collection of architects, master plasterers, carpenters, and painters has worked hand in hand to repair the hall, presumably as the team that created this artistic jewel did 600 years ago. One achievement was inventing a restorative mortar that's imperceptible to the viewer. The stealth ingredient is quinine. If we want to show a reconstructed segment, we have to use ultraviolet light, says Ramon Rubio, who leads the stucco and tile restoration workshop. Who were the painters of these scenes showing the last vestige of coexistence between Muslims and Christians before the fall of Granada? Experts say they could have been Christian artisans from neighboring kingdoms that commercially traded with the empire, mainly those on the Italian peninsula and particularly Genoa, or Muslims who knew the Renaissance techniques of those courts. Despite the arduous research involved in the restoration, in this place, as in so many others in the Alhambra, mysteries remain. I look over the Alpachin, Granada's labyrinth medieval quarter, built on a hill opposite the Alhambra. With its whitewashed facades, villas, and hidden gardens of cypress trees, it's hard to imagine a more perfect view. I descend toward the Alpachin down a lane known as Cuesta de Rio Chico, Little King, departing as the 24th and last Nazarene Sultan did when he left the fortress forever. Crossing into that parallel world, I see the Alhambra as his subjects might have. From the Alpachin, the Alhambra's palaces can be read chronologically from right to left, like Arabic itself. The language can still be heard in the quarter, which is lined with tea shops and has the ambience of a souk. As Boabdil was deposed, residents were allowed to keep their businesses, homes, language, and religion, but that spirit of coexistence lasted only 8 years. By 1501, Muslims were forced to flee or convert to Christianity. I peer into the Dar al-Hora Palace, the home of Boabdil's mother and his final refuge in Granada, before he fled to Morocco. Nothing on the outside gives away its graceful interior. Like the Alhambra, the exterior reveals little. Beauty is unveiled only within. Before leaving, I pause for one last look. My friend Blanca Rooney, a veteran guide, is beside me. I've seen it many times, she says. It's the look of someone who is bidding farewell to the Alhambra, as if they had just been expelled from it. And that concludes the article, Fortress of Faith, written by Emma Lira. Visiting Granada. The city's rich heritage offers unique experiences for visitors. The Alhambra. Book tickets at least 1 to 2 months ahead. General admission allows access to the Alcazaba, Nazarene palaces, Pardal, and general life. The visit is mostly outdoors, making spring and fall ideal times. Don't miss the courtyard of the Lion's Fountain and the courtyard of the Myrtles, with facades reflecting in its pool. King Charles V's palace, home to the two museums, may be visited without a ticket. The Monastery of San Francisco, where monarchs Isabella and Ferdinand were initially interred, is now a hotel and restaurant that serves cuisine based on Nazarene court recipes. Alpachan. In this winding old quarter, once the center of Granada's Muslim life, boutique hotels occupy villas from the Nasrid dynasty's era. Our pick is the 15th century Hotel Casa Morisca, an alternative to the Alpachan's steep streets and the centrally located Palacio de los Patos, a 19th century magnate's mansion. At Carmen de Aban Humilla, dinners take in a view of the Alhambra from within its walled garden, a distinguishing feature of traditional Carmen dwellings. The San Nicolas lookout and the adjacent mosque gardens are classic spots for watching the sunset over the Alhambra. Sacromonte. Nearby, Sacromonte is the birthplace of flamenco, a dance created by the Romani community, settled here for more than 500 years. Many live in the area's characteristic caves where Muslims took refuge after the fall of the city, and some say also influenced the music of the dance. Cave bars now host performances, including Cueva del Arrucio. A scenic walk to the neighborhood passes through El Paseo and de los Tristes and La Carrera del Darro along the river. Our last article is found in the Field Notes section of the magazine, titled Circling the Globe in Search of the Past. Albert Lin is a rare kind of engineer, one who scales cliffs, battles rivers, and rappels into caverns. The National Geographic Explorer is on a quest to uncover the hidden remnants of former civilizations for his new show, Lost Cities Revealed with Albert Lin. He not only uses data, drones, and modeling software and aerial imaging to locate relics, but he also hikes into forests, deserts, and jungles with the help of a titanium prosthesis in place of his right leg, which he lost after a vehicle accident. Journeys take him to the mountains of Peru to find the Cloud Warrior people conquered by the Incan, and to Oman to explore Magan, a Bronze Age land. He visits ancient pyramids in Sudan and a former settlement of Scottish tribespeople whose members fought off the Roman army. There's still so much to be learned about who we are and where we come from, Lin says. The series is filled with twists, often unexpected acts of nature, such as a tense rafting accident, and harrowing suspense, like a night camping beside one of the world's deadliest scorpions. While Lin was looking for the biblical Canaanites in Israel, a falling boulder shattered his prosthetic leg. Luckily, he had a spare. That's Circling the Globe in Search of the Past, written by Daniel Stone. You can catch season one of Lost Cities Revealed with Albert Lin on National Geographic starting November 23rd and Disney Plus on November 29th. That's it for this edition of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the December edition of National Geographic Magazine. I'm Jennifer Ackerman. So long till next time.